Welcome to On Farm Trials with the PNW Farmers Network, where we explore the many trials that come along with cropping systems innovation in the inland Pacific Northwest. Plenty of questions get asked while farming across this region, and together, we're digging into what it's like to try to answer some of them as producers, researchers, and the many other professionals in the field that get things done. We're glad you're here. I'm your host, Carol McFarland. Today, we're excited to be out here with Mr. Tracy Erickson on Lenscoff Incorporated, his farm outside of St. John, Washington. Thank you so much for being on the podcast and welcome.
Thank you, Carol. I enjoyed having you out here.
Thanks so much, Tracy. Would you start off by telling us a little bit more about yourself, your farm, who you farm with?
How far you want to go back on the history is that. But my grandfather came here in 1897. And actually came to this place where we're residing right now in 1907. And my father was raised in this house. And I was raised about a mile down the road. And then ever since my married life, I've been in what would be my grandfather's house here. So we have moved about a mile or a mile and a half in 84 years, so 83 years. So anyhow, we haven't moved very far. My grandfather did homestead a place, but that was about 7 miles away, and he sold that to his brother in 1907 when he came up here and settled here. Married my grandmother, who lived a mile behind, and the rest of it's history there. So
it does sound like history. You're definitely part of the legacy of this landscape and your family and the whole area.
Yes. And, you know, there's a lot of stories like that around here. And we're just one of them.
That's one of the wonderful things about being in this part of this world. You want to talk a bit more about who you're farming with these days, or are you still farming? I hear you're trying to retire.
Well, I sort of ended up sending what books I used to take in last November to my older son, who is back with us now. He's been with us 3 or 4 years. I've had one son, Kai. He's been with me since 1994, after he graduated from University of Idaho, actually. And been with me ever since that time. And has been with me most of our no-tilling years. Say our first no-tilling probably started about 85. I've been looking at it since 74, but it took about 85 before we started. Devin's with me now. It's been a long, slow process of evolution, of getting out of the conventional. I spent 20-some years in an open cab tractor tilling the ground, and then I spent another 20 or so years still tilling, which is about 70 years now. And I've actually affected this ground the same amount of time as both of my predecessors, my grandfather and my father both. When they added up what they were doing on here, I've been here about the same length of time. So I probably have had more influence on either the destruction side and trying to improve it than anybody else that's been on this piece of property. But it's been an evolution, been slow. Wished it could have been hurried, but that's the way it is.
I think ag time is a little different than some other timelines, isn't it?
Yeah. My father was always pretty progressive at that time, but you know, he got away from the plowing very early. I really never did run a plow. I have, but it was never one of those things that we did field in and field out. We were mostly disking and chiseling by the time I kind of got involved, which was, in our estimation at that time, was an improvement. Now, looking back on it, I'm not too sure it really was from a soil health aspect of it.
No, I appreciate you sharing that and the perspective of just how much, you know, you have influenced the land in your management choices. And I'm looking forward to hearing more about that and all the things you've tried along the way. You're talking about tilling and, you know, out here in the St. John area, you got some good Palouse Hills. You want to talk a little bit more about the landscape that you farm, your precip and your soil?
We farm in the St. John area. We're in about a 15-inch rainfall area, plus or minus. In 1976, we took over some of my wife's family ground at Thornton. That's about an 18-inch rainfall area. We have kind of divided our fields up, so we've got about 14 different fields, and there is not a one of them with a consistent soil. The least is 4 soils, and the most is 10 soils of varying productivity on them. So we're on the hills. We used to farm 40%+ hills. Most of that has been grassed out now. So there's very little that we farm that's over 30-35%. There's less than 10% that I would call level, which I would say is anything under 5%. So we're on the western edge of the Palouse Hills, quite close to the scabland. So we have in light soil, most of it's pretty light soil. So they run, if they are over cultivated, they run down the hill. And that was really probably the thing that really kind of set me onto this road. Is in 1975, I was too lazy to get off of a tractor and get a piece of post that was in the road or in my track. And I watched that post go from the hilltop to the hill bottom in one season, just from our cultivation. And it would just move a little bit every time I did a pass. And I said, and then I'd watch the soil flow down the road in front of my weeder. And I said, my kids are never going to be able to farm this ground. There won't be anything left if I keep eroding it the way it's going here. So from about that point on, then I started working at ways to stop that. It was a slow process.
It sounds like you had some years of observational data points as you're thinking, as that got your wheels turning toward shifting your management choices. So do you want to talk a little bit more about what was your standard rotation, or what kind of has historically been your standard rotation, and then how that's changed over time?
Our whole region here started out when my grandfather was on this, and then early years of my father, we raised turkey red wheat. That was hard red wheat. That was standard. My father, he told me, he said, I raised turkey red until they wouldn't take it anymore at the elevator. So that was when we changed over. And when my early farming days, basically it was all club wheat. The whole region was club wheat. And in 1960, we had a stem rust, I believe it was, came in, or leaf rust, and took out all the whole countryside. Fortunately, Gaines had just become, it was a common wheat, and Gaines had just hit the market. And that's probably the first real flip that I've saw people do wholesale. It went from a club wheat to Gaines wheat in basically a 1 year time, because it just, the rust just devastated our club wheats. Wow. So we've been in the common wheat, common soft white wheat, since that point. We have done some DNS for wheats, but and barley, we used to put barley into the rotation. Most of my father's career was a three-year rotation. We had winter wheat, and you had spring barley, and then you had fallow. We've broken that rotation up, and as the years have gone, so it's, there's no real standard rotation out there, but we call it mostly a 3 year. When Kai got more involved here, he wanted to go up to like a 6 year rotation. Economics told us that really wasn't going to work out very well. As much as we'd like to do that, that just didn't work. So we're back to the 3 years for the most part, or the 4 year, depending on where we are.
I'm actually curious about what types of things you've tried growing as part of your rotation.
Prior to 1985, when the Farm Bill came and they released us from our bases, up to that point, you were locked into braces, into bases, and we had to raise wheat, and we had to raise right up the maximum of what the base allowed us, or we'd lose that. So the government really made this wheat farmers. Those up east of us, they were complaining at the time because they were in a pea, wheat, barley rotation. Well, the wheat base for them got knocked back because they had other crops. Most of us down here in the Fowler area, it was half wheat at that time, early in the 60s when that program came about. And so we had a wheat fallow, and then there would be some barley. We had a low barley base, but we protected that because that's what the program payments and everything. That was where we were in terms of rotation early on, is wheat fallow for us. When 85 came and they separated the bases and that somewhat, then we started able to do some other stuff. I went in and started raising some spring peas, yellows, and we had more spring barley and wheat, but that was about as far as it went. 76, we went up to Thornton and started on that. We were really annual cropping up there with winter wheat and spring wheat for many years, and then we got into some peas to replace the spring wheat and some barley. I did raise winter barley for a year or two, but the winter barley didn't quite fit the program. As years transpired, we were able to do a little bit more. And then in 1994, we went back to Pierre, South Dakota, to Dwayne Beck's place. Kai and I went in the spring of 95, actually. And we got to see what they were doing. And we started coming back, then started increasing. And we started trying to incorporate a little later in the some mustards, and more recently, canola. And we've had some garbs on here. We've had, garb. Well, last year we raised soybeans.
Did you?
Well, we say we raised them.
All right. Well, you gotta tell me how that went.
We got enough seed back that we're going to plant another year. But I think we... No, they didn't do well, put it that way. But we're not giving up yet. But we're going to go one more year. From what I hear, we're going one more year. So we got a little acreage, and we'll just kind of see. It was a bad year last year to do soybeans on dry land. We were going to put some on irrigated this year. We have a little bit of irrigated property. The discussion recently is that, you know, we've got beyond on most of that ground. I don't think we can put soybeans on that. So we know beyond is not going to work well at all, even if it's 2 years out. So I think that has yet to be determined where we're going to put them. But we will probably try some again. Mm. But it's likely to be one of those two times and out, not three times or four times, but we'll see.
Well, I'm curious about that. I mean, you are kind of a legendary innovator, as it goes. And when you are trying something, how do you decide whether it's you try it once and like, this isn't really showing any promise versus carrying it out for 2 years or three or four? Like, how do you make some of those decisions on whether it's worth it and how to try it?
Oh, it's mostly a gut feeling. In our case, we have... we have an individual who wants to put soybeans into the area, bring them in here. He thinks he has some varieties that might grow in here because this is not a soybean area, and I'm not sure it'll ever be. But said, okay, we'll try it a little bit. We raised soybeans, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 years ago on a little 30-acre patch, and they really look good. And this was before the new variety. They make a lot of changes in soybeans, variety-wise, to try to get them to shorter season, get them in different locations. The soybeans that we had started look really good. We had them under irrigation. We were going to try a little. They were Roundup ready soybeans. When it was time to give them a chemical job, we had a custom operation come in. They had a contaminated tank, apparently, because They never grew after that. We got paid very well by the company. They tried their best to figure out what happened. So I did do it, but got absolutely no data off of that. McGregor come in and asked her whether we could raise soybeans. She was a soybean breeder, and she says, this is really not an area, not enough humidity, not enough heat, blah, blah, blah. So my interest went really down to nothing until another fellow came in and he said, I think we got some soybeans that maybe will work up here. So he said, okay, we'll give it a few acres. He wanted 200 acres. I said, no way. We'll do roughly 30.
So this was your second round on soybeans.
This was the second round on soybeans. And so we gave the fellow, you know, a 30-acre field, roughly. It was 27, I think, as it turned out. He brought the seed up to us, and we planted it, and it turned out to be a droughty year and dry land, and I didn't think we'd have anything growing. And actually, they did flower, and they did some potting, but not really well. We did harvest them. I wasn't sure whether it was even going to be worth. But we did harvest them, and we got 3 bags out of 30 acres, totes. Mm-hmm. So we're going to just turn that around and seed them back. We got to figure out how to maybe scalp them and get some of the garbage out. The germination on them is really poor. It's like 55%. When I did the germ, I got 90%, but I only took what I thought might germ.
So a little bit of a biased sample there.
There's a lot of not good seed in there. Yeah. It's pretty obvious.
No, I know when we were talking with Garrett Heineck and Garrett Moon out in the Horse Heaven Hills on their Kernza, and they were talking about how they were exploring the downside potential of Kernza. And if it worked out there, it'd work other places for sure. It sounds like you did that with your soybean trial this last year, was really explored that downside potential.
Quite frankly, we do not have a lot of hope for them yet. They're in the future, yeah, I think maybe there's a potential, particularly if our climate keeps warming, which most likely it will, and the moisture. We heard yesterday from the weatherman that, yeah, it seemed to be getting a little more moist, you know. Maybe it'll come this way. But yeah, it's one of those things that you try and you hope for success, and the likelihood is probably not great, but you give it a try.
One of the things I'm curious about, so, you know, you kind of keep your curiosity around the soybeans as a prospective alternative crop in your rotation. What's driving that for you? What sort of management goals are you hoping? Is it economics? Is it soil? What is it?
Diversity.
Yeah.
Crop diversity basically is what I've become, you know, my interest once I got into the soil health issue. Even before that, when I was more interested in listening to Beck, crop diversity was always his thing. More diversity, the better. So it's one of those, you know, what we're pretty limited. We were wheat and barley and you know, there were some peas and that here, but we needed more diversity, so we look at those crops. That's why we basically got into canola and mustards and things like that, and garbanzo beans. So just to get the diversity in there. The more current with the cover crops now is basically to get diversity out there. As I learn more about the microbiology in the soil, the critters need feeding. They need different food, different critters. So, you know, it's all about the diversity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit more about your soil health journey? I know you've been thinking about that a lot.
The used to be soil health to me was just stop the erosion. You know, get no-till, that'll do it all, blah, blah. Well, that didn't quite work. Yes, we stopped the erosion, but still we were taking material off the ground. We really started seeing that we weren't putting anything back on there, even though we left everything in place. So the journey kind of started as to get rid of the erosion. We went from cultivation to less cultivation and combining of our operations out there. I spent all winter for many years putting equipment together, combining, like putting a harrow on a cultivator and doing that in one operation and adding chemistry to it and doing that in the operation. Finally, we got to the point that no-tilling looked like it was a potential. This was in 85. And then I started renting some big drills to do the winter wheat. And then we started doing a few in the spring. 92, I thought I really knew how to do no-tilling, and I bought a no-till drill, and then we spent another 20 years trying to figure out how no-till worked.
Okay, you got to tell me, what was that? Tell me about those early drills and then how that's evolved over time.
We bought an Ag Pro, very narrow hole. It put the fertilizer in with our seed net. That was 92. And then we modified that. It was, you know, not too bad for disturbance, but it disturbed quite a bit of soil. Then I modified that to an AccuPlant double disc that had notched blades on it. We kept our fertilizer there with it. That turned out to be a problem. We kept that a few years, but it was a problem for hairpinning. During that period, I put in some high-pressure fertilizer to try to get rid of the shank. That didn't really work out that well. I couldn't get it in the ground deep enough. The aqua always smelled bad. And if you're in the draw and you had to stop, that could have been a problem. So after a couple of years, I got rid of that. Then we went back to a hole drill with a 4-inch and spread out, because we were starting to build residue, then it was getting to be a problem. Residue has been a problem for me for 40, 50 years. It's how do you work with that without destroying it? So we went to spread out our machine, and we put a hole drill back with a 4-inch point, and then we went to a 6-inch point and spread out a little more. By the time 2010 hit, the residue, our rotation at the time was really built residue, winter wheat residue, and we just couldn't handle it. We had that 2010 was a really bad year for rodents in the field. Everybody had bad rodents. Mostly you could see that just around the grass edges, and you'd always have stuff coming out around those with rodents eating off the wheat. Well, we had mounds all over the field from residue that was piled and dropped off the drill and that. So we had little condos for rodents all over the field. So we had some big holes in our crop. They didn't kill it. It came through, but it affected us. But that, we said at that time, we can't handle that anymore. We double mowed it. We'd done all this, but that didn't work because all the tracks that you leave every time you get a piece of equipment on the ground. At that time, we knew the crosslot looked to me like it might be a right way to go. And then 2014, we built our own crosslot drill. And in the years, my no-tilling years from, say, 85 on, it seemed to me like I spent more time under the drill than I did in the seat of the tractor. And when I built that drill in 14 with the boys, we tried to design it so that we had much easier access to the drill. It was easier to work on. It's been a very successful drill.
What is it that makes it kind of the most successful drill that you've kind of optimized at this point?
Well, it's easy to work on. Still a lot of heavy equipment, but it's easy to work on. It's very versatile. We can seed on 10-inch spaces. We can seed on 20-inch spaces. We have very little disturbance with that drill. We disturb about, I think, total disturbance is about maybe an inch and a half is all that even gets any of it. But it cuts a slot. That we found actually that we can really bring a crop up in about double the depth of normal drills because it'll come up in that slot and do its thing. So that aspect is good. One of the downsides with that drill, though, is it's a expensive drill to run because of the wear pieces that's on it. But if it's got an automatic downforce system on it that keeps the pressure where you want, so you can have your keep an even seating depth. If that system isn't working, it's not a good drill. And we have some issues with that on time. So, but, you know, and for the most part, we've kind of learned that you stop and fix it. You don't try to work through it, or you're not going to have a good crop. So it's got its good pieces, features, and it's got some not good. That's just typical of every drill out there.
Well, and I hear you talking about crop diversity, and one of the things that, you know, comes up with different drills, especially in different places around this dry land region of the Inland Northwest, a lot of different seeding conditions people are working with. And especially when you talk about diversity being part of your management plan, the drill can be a big part of that. So is that drill as successful with canola as with peas or your cover crop mixes?
Yes, the cross-sod drill is very versatile. We would like to have, I think we're finding out, it would be better to have a planter for things like canola and just small seeded stuff, and probably even for other crops, peas, maybe even for wheat. And I can see the potential for the boys to move to a planter sometime down in the future. But right now, the cross lot is doing it. We can go through just about anything out there in terms of residue. I'd say our fight with residue has diminished 80-90% where we couldn't do it. You know, there's other single disc drills out there that I think do a good job. And they're certainly much better in terms of disturbance than a hole drill of any type. The hole drill that we originally started with is still a very viable drill. They're still selling that drill today, what, 30 years later? They got a lot of different configuration, but you can still buy that same type of operation.
Yeah.
And people do. They like it.
So how does it go when you, I guess I brought up the seeding of cover crops. I know that can be, especially if you're doing, do you prefer mixed species or are you more of a single cover crop?
I've never considered anything but a mixed species, but I see more reading in that, you know, there's like rye, which is a bad word around here. That seems to be a very popular cover crop as a single species in the Midwest and in the East. But I've always considered multi-species. I've gone up as high as 9 or 10 species, down to 3 or 4. We have separated large seed again and small seed because we have that capability of drilling it with a cross lot. I think the tendency maybe is that we're going to just continue mixing them together. We did 1 or 2 years that we divided that out. I'm not sure we see that as a real advantage. We have seeded some wheat into it. We're still working on that. We were in a project where we were really moving wheat early into the season. We were part of the study that then you started hearing things about wheat mosaic and high plains disease and fusarium. And so we had to back off that. We're still trying to figure out just how early you can seed that wheat. At this point, it looks like middle of August, maybe, is about as early as we want. We know that June is too early. Mm-hmm. We're thinking that July is too early. We've had some stuff seeded at the third week of August, and that seems to have no problem.
Okay, so when you're trying to experiment with your planting date, do you want to just speak a little bit more to, you know, when you're trying something different, in that case, what What are you looking for?
Mostly to get cover, get it up early. One of the things that we've learned with the cross lot is it took me a long time no-tilling to get it, because I grew up around WSU's research. I've been to a lot of their research, the conservation, and there were certain things you had to do. I mean, you couldn't seed, you didn't want to seed early because you would get aphid, or you would get some disease or whatever. You had to wait for the cheatgrass to come up because of our rotation. So you had to wait for the rains to get the cheatgrass up. And by that time, we were really late in our seedings, like October, early October. I was taking a yield hit in terms of what the neighbors were doing at that time. And actually, Kai is the one that got us on the straight on that. I kept saying, well, we need to seed earlier, but we couldn't do it because this, and this. Finally, Kai just went out seeded early. And our yield has been great. So really, one of the things we have to do, or we've convinced our own mind that we have to do, is you can't let the moisture get away from you. If you're going to have a dry fall and you've got moisture in, say, late August, seed it. Don't wait. If you're trying to seed into a cover crop, you're not going to have that moisture. Unless you got the early rain. So, you know, you're going to give that up. And we're too early yet to know how much of a yield hit are we going to get. We know we're going to get a potentially everywhere from 10 to 30 bushel yield hit normally. Can we improve? My idea here is, can we improve the soil health with our cover crops that we can get them to emerge a little later and still hold our yield? Not sure of that. Probably not.
Do you want to talk a little bit more about some of your adventures in cover crops? Like, when did you first start those? And I know that you're part of the PNW cover crop collaboration with the University of Idaho, and maybe some other projects going on.
That's true. We're in two projects right now. Our first cover crop went in 2017, and it was some new ground that we took on, shallow ground, rocky, very complex. And it had been in CRP for 25, 30 years. It came out, we put a crop or two on it, then we no-tailed it out, and then we went back with a cover crop. And it's had two cover crops on it now. There was a 70-acre area that we... And it looked to me like one cover crop we haven't been able to see, or even in our own wildest minds envision that it's been an improvement yield-wise. The second one, we're starting to think maybe, two cover crops out, maybe we're starting to see. Because one of the areas, very poor ground, it yielded the best in 2022. It was even better than 2020, which was actually everybody's great year. 2022, depending on where you were good years. We had a great year in 22. So, you know, we're starting to see, and the boys are starting to see, maybe these cover crops, you know, if we can get them included here, will have some value to us. We're still pretty early in that. But we started in 15. That was our first one. The one that I really liked, we did in 16. We put 100 acres of a multi-mix with radish on the hills area. We had a big runoff that year. And I was out in the field watching that stuff go off in the spring. We had a Chinook. We didn't have a lot of snow, but it went fast. Water was rolling everything. I was on our chem fallow winter wheat, which we had good cover on. The water was leaving quite clear, but it was still, we were losing that. And all I could see by this time is yield going down the creek, you know. Then I went over and walked over the area that we had our cover crop on, which included radish. I like radish. And there was no water movement at all on that ground. And there were slopes there of 30% on some of that ground. So more I looked at that, the better I liked it. I said, yeah, we kept our moisture. It's going in the ground. We're not losing anything. If you're losing water, you're losing soil. You can't help moving water moves stuff. You got nutrients, you got pesticides, you got whatever. It's going down. Even though I took some jar samples and it looked pretty good, it was pretty obvious that we were losing stuff.
You really touch on an interesting point there with erosion. You're not just losing, you know, soil, the base resource on the farm, but you're also losing nutrients with that soil fixed to the soil particles, and that's stuff you've spent money on as well.
And there's always a herbicide. You want to keep that. So, you know, we're working on cover crops now to try to, you know, try to release some of the, we got soil samples. One of the problems I've had over the years, I've spent tens of thousands of dollars on soil samples, and for the most part, haven't done anything with them. I mean, we take our soil samples before we put our fall crop in, and they'll ask you, oh, what do you put on for? Well, we put on da-da. What did you do like? Same thing before. A lot of times we haven't changed much for the most part on that because it all comes out about the same. But we have some of the newer soil samples. I think it was out of Ward's lab. We got a total availability of nutrients. Actually, it's telling us in the place that we were taking that sample, we have all of the necessary nutrients for a long time. The plant just cannot access it. So that takes microbiology to do that. So we're now kind of gearing ourselves to how to get those nutrients released that's in the soil, not adding so much. We're finding out that the more we add, like nitrogen and that, probably not doing us so good. It's locking up other nutrients. We're doing more and more leaf testing and comparing the old leaf with the new leaf. And we need to get into probably more foliar. So we're moving that direction.
Well, and this is a question I've asked around generally, but as you think about nutrient availability and microbes and all of this, on your farm, what does pH look like in all of that?
Our pH is around 5. It runs from around 5.5 to 6.1, depending on where you are. I'd like to have it higher. On liming, we are trying to do less of the pH lowering fertilizer. My goal is, and I think the boys are sort of following along on this, is eventually we don't really put anything down with the seed. We do it all foliar, or we put very little with the seed, and then we do foliar. If we can figure out how to do it without killing the plant and do it frequently, I think we can do that in the future.
Just all, when you're talking about nutrient availability in the soil, I think about pH. But I mean, it's not, the closer you are to neutral, of course. But I noticed you got a microscope over there in the corner of your office.
Well, and I learned about Dr. Elaine Ingham in 2016. Actually, I was able to get that through one of the wheat colleges. She was a speaker over at Ritzville. And after listening to her presentation, I got in touch with her, and then I joined and took two of her classes. One was just basically a biological identification class, and then it was all online. So I could identify, you know, nematodes and amoebas and flagellates and bacterium and fungi. I can identify them now and see that. And that was in preparation to start developing some teas and some extracts. And, you know, that's a whole nother story. But anyhow, yes, that was just part of my education there, is to learn. I was asked by an individual, he said, if you get done with that, he says, I'd be willing to buy it. I says, oh, it stays on the ranch as long as I'm here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I hear that as part of your soil health journey. You know, you're really embracing that soil as a vital living ecosystem and not a substrate.
It is a living. We don't recognize it. And I never recognize it. I still don't recognize it. But it is just amazing when you put that stuff under that slide, just what's there, what's wiggling around in that. It's a whole different perspective of life.
Oh, we just had the Washington Soil Health Initiative just did the Soil Con for 2024 recently. And there was a great talk on soil biodiversity in that as well. So I know the recordings will be available.
We're looking forward to that.
Yeah, if you're interested in that, yeah. If you didn't catch it live, that, it was fun. It was a good... Oh. Good rundown of all the different critters in the soil. It sounds like you already know them and you've got the microscope to ID them. So,
there was a time I thought all nematodes were bad. That was a revelation to me to find out. No, nematodes are a main critter to do some conversions for us. And yeah, you don't want the plant eaters.
Hopefully by the time this comes out, I'm trying to rope someone in for talking about nematodes on the Soil Health Coffee Hour. So hopefully by the time this goes live, we'll have gotten that one in too. No, I can vouch for how many research and WSU-sponsored events that you've been to, including on soil health and other conservation districts. How do you see the... I guess that interaction between the research and how it applies and inspires your on-farm trials?
Well, it's, the university research is getting much better. Earlier on, a lot of the use or the reason for the biological groups that have been going on is that we were not getting the research out of the colleges that we needed to do what some of us were seeing that needed to be done. But we've also, I've noticed over the last 3-4 years particularly, a big jump in interest. Maybe it's been more than 3 or 4 years. Well, since 16 anyhow. But it's there's a big interest coming up, and we're getting more, I think, good research out of that. And so everybody's kind of catching up on board. I think there's a lot of discoordination yet in the university of the different specialists talking to one another and looking for alternatives and to some of our chemistry that we're having. We're going to have issues there. We're going to, I think it can be done, not through synthetic chemistry, put it that way. Mm-hmm. But
just in some of our other conversations, and, you know, rumor has it a little bit too, that you've been thinking about ways to reduce your synthetic chemistry on your place. How has that been looking for you?
Well, right now it looks very good. We basically cut our chemistry needs in half, and we did that in 1 year. And part of our biological group, I was in 2020, the subject of structured water came into play. It's a Persanova system with Vachi. I can't pronounce his last name at all. The Spokane Conservation District put out or developed or put together a Persanova system, put it out to a farmer to, you know, kind of get some real experience on this stuff. Turned out there was a lot of problems that developed, and so they had to do some rebuilding and a new learning curve. And then it was by the summer of 2021, that system was all put together, and the issues seemed to be understood and mitigated. You know, we were able to get it in August, and then we started producing the water, or I was doing some tests and studies on it, and we started cutting back that fall on some of our chemistry, and it looked really good. Primarily, I cut back a lot on the Roundup. So come the winter, well, this system was doing really well, and we were talking it up within the group, and I said, well, you know, we're going to have, you know, we're going to need so many gallons, and everybody else in the 150-mile radius are going to need this thing. We're going to have problems of getting it timely to get the product that we have. And it doesn't store itself that well. The structured water, from the time you quit doing the circulation, the new idea on it is it will gradually start to decrease, and by 2 weeks it's down some more, and maybe a couple of months it's, you know, down. Anyhow, it was going to be at close to a $50,000 bill, And I said, okay, let's bite and let's go for it. And if we can, and we figured out, we penciled out, if we can just cut that half, we'll have that paid off quick. And we did. We just arbitrarily just chopped everything in half. And our response was very good. We paid for that unit in about 6 months, just in what we normally had done the year before against what we were doing. We continue. We aren't cutting anymore for the most part. But this Personova system really wasn't built for the purpose of getting rid of the chemistry. It was supposed to be for fertilizing, getting your plant foliar feeding, and we haven't even touched that yet. Mm. We're doing it. Well, that's kind of our next phase on that. We're satisfied with the system, and that's where we are on that.
When you're trying something like that, I guess, you know, I hear you talking a little bit, it sounds maybe like you kind of went all in on that one rather than, you know, with your soybeans, you're like, okay, we did 30 acres.
Yeah.
But with this, I mean, how did trying the water look different in terms of an on-farm trial?
As I mentioned, we started this in about 2020 in the group, and that group discussion went on. And then I went and I started calling around in the East Coast some people, because this is not a new system. This has been out roughly 15 or 20 years by the time I got to it. And so I started talking to a few people on the East Coast that had it, and they were very satisfied with it. There was a couple of big growers of specialty crops that really weren't willing to share anything. It's a marketing thing that they do. Avachi was putting a lot of money into them, but it was all of this behind the wall thing, so we didn't get anything on that. But I figured at this point that if we bombed 1 year, that wasn't going to be bad. So that was really kind of the decision we made. I figured that we could cut our costs 1 year, which would pay for that thing. But no, it worked. We're satisfied. We got to watch it. You know, it makes the weed scientists at the universities, they don't like it. And it's understandable, and I understand their position at all. And we have to be very careful and not let anything get away, because we're cutting those rates down. We're at the very bottom of the labels. So, yeah, we got to watch for misses.
Well, and it sounds like with your crop rotations, one of the benefits of diversifying is diversifying your chemistry portfolio. So that probably helps as well.
Yeah, we pay attention to that. We try to stay out of the long, persistent stuff. You know, a field that we bought recently has got goat grass on it. Mm-hmm. So that's what brought Beyond into our... Like, you know, we want to get around that and out of that as quick as possible. How long that's going to take the boys to do, I don't know. It's beyond me now. It's going to have to be them.
Yeah, well, that's the benefit.
But they're aware. They know what the issues are. We'll go from there.
Mm. Okay, we got a couple other questions here for you. Do you want to share a little bit about the most memorable time when you experienced unintended consequences from a trial?
I really haven't had any... really bad unintended. I suppose actually our recent soybean, or my history with soybean, I've gone really slow on most of the changes. And I've either seen early with a small acreage. And all the thing that I've done, the economics have never come into play. It's just, you know, like a new crop, you got to learn to grow it before you even consider whether it's going to make money or not. I want to see if it'll grow. You know, I'm looking at soil health issues, biology, what it'll do for that. If we can take small acre, if we can make it grow and look good, then we start looking at the economics of it. If somebody comes up with an idea and says, oh, can you make money? Oh, heck, I don't know. We'll see if we can do this, and then we'll see whether we can make any money. You just don't want to bet the farm on the whole thing. Now, basically, I suppose you'd say the Personova water system, I bet the farm on. So, I mean, a $50,000 bill is a pretty good sized bill. But we had that pretty well figured out beforehand. We were prepared. Our operation was prepared to make the cuts we needed to do what we needed. If it didn't work, then we'd back out of it, but we could do that. And when all of the modifications I did for 20, 30 years, the equipment, the thing that I always looked at when I spent all winter making these modifications, part of that was how long was it going to take me to back out of that? How many days was it going to take me to reconvert my drill or my cultivating system back to where it was that I knew would work? And I always planned that around a day's change. If things didn't work, I was going to lose a day to strip it all out of there and get it back. But I never went to the point that I just totally dismantled something. And so I really never had any of those events where things were really a failure.
Yeah. No,
they were always manageable.
Sounds like a lot of great innovation winning. No, but it sounds like you really are doing your homework and understanding your risk tolerance threshold, I think might be a word for some of that. Yeah. When you're trying stuff, where and how do you try things? If you're just doing that, trying something on a smaller scale, do you like mark it out? Do you keep notes? You know, there's just some like really basic kind of pro tips. What have you learned over the years? What's a good system for some of those things?
Well, I know when talking around with people, a lot of people, I'll try this little thing on a back 40 or on a back 20 or somewhere. I was never that way. It's always out on the road. Mostly, I kept stuff in my head. I know some people really take detailed notes on everything they do and how it works out. I really never did that. Everything is exposed. Everybody else can see it because I can see it too. And if it's out in the back, well, I get busy on something. We're not a big enough operation. For many years, I was doing it myself until I got one of my boys, Kai, come back, and then there was two of us. But still seemed like we always had enough stuff. You just go from one thing to the other, and you don't have too much time to look over your shoulder to see what happened over here. But if it's out in front of you, you can kind of keep track of it. And, since 2012, I've had a blog. And I used to keep it up really well.
Yeah.
But in the last about 3-4 years, I'm not in the field like I used to be. And I find I'm not observing. I'm having trouble. I'm not sure how much longer I'll even try to keep that blog going because I'm just not out there doing the observations that I was. We just kind of do it by the seat of the pants, an awful lot of it. You know, if it looks like it's growing good, we'll dig in the soil and we'll look around and see what plant growth and give it some thought as to, is it doing what we want? Some of the soil tests. Now, I've always been critical of soil tests, but we're getting better on those. We're getting more different soil tests. It's the sap test, spoke of a little bit earlier. We're getting really more involved on that, and I think we'll be able to tell better with that along with some of the other newer tests out there. The Haney test has never really caught on with me too much.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of different thoughts around that test for sure. Thanks for speaking a little bit to some of the things you look for to know if a trial is successful and really like kind of what data looks like on the farm to you. And also that you're one of the ones that puts it right out there in front so everybody can see it, including yourself. Well, Tracy, one of the things I was encouraged to ask you, what are the top three craziest things you've tried on your farm?
Well, I suppose really the Personova water system was probably the craziest. Uh-huh. And people ask me, well, how does that work? I don't know. I've done some reading on it, and that kind of came from a suggestion by Gerald Pollock. Pollock from the University of Washington. He's got several books, but one of them is Easy Water, which is the exclusionary zone water. It's also, he's got a book out on the fourth stage of water. I've seen a lot of his videos. They're fascinating. Water is not what we think water is. I mean, what we envision. There's a lot more to water than that. I watched several of his videos, and as part of our study to kind of figure out what's going on. But just recognizing that water isn't just the water we think of. It can be shaped a little bit, which makes it different in terms of what it can do and the energy it can store. You know, 5 years ago, that was, you know, that's just crazy. But so was the idea that plants actually can communicate with themselves. 5 years ago, 6 years ago, that was pretty off the wall. So when I first heard that from Elaine Ingham in 2016, I said, what are we talking about? This is crazy stuff. But it's not so crazy anymore now that you have a little more, we have a little more understanding of that. And we know, yet even, we know so little about our soil biology and what's going on. And there's a lot of processes that's going on that we just don't know how it's done yet. That's kind of the way it is with this water thing. Some of our savings from our chemistry is probably the fact our suppliers and our the people that we rely on for that information, they got a lot of pressure on them. But the tendency is the worst thing that a salesman can have is to sell a product that does not work. So if you got a chemistry guy giving you product, he wants to make sure that weed is dead. We may have been putting on too much. That might be the reason that we can cut back some of that and not show any real problem. But that would be the craziest thing that we had done. And we banked a lot of money on it with some research that we thought we could get by with it and hoping it worked. And it did.
Well, I also hear that you're very curious. I think it seems like you're just a kind of that lifelong learning is just a part of who you are. And it sounds like you also really do your homework and getting a lot of different sources of information on something before you, you know, bet the farm. And that you're also aware of potential risks. I hear you saying, well, escapes are a possibility. We are watching for those as part of this, as we try this innovation. And so you said top three, Tracy.
Well, I'm trying to think top three, and that one has really stuck out because that was a pretty big bite. I would say probably the other one was just the buying our first no-till drill. I really thought I had done enough and had seen enough stuff that was going to be successful. And to a point it was, but that was a pretty high risk and it didn't go well. I mean, it didn't go as well as I was expecting it to. I took a couple of trips back to Beck, talking to the, learning more what it is. As my second trip, I went back and I said, well, I've applied your 5 points to make successful no-till. And I said, I'm having trouble with that. And he just sort of grinned at me. He says, well, he says, I gained my PhD developing those five basics of successful no-till. And he says, you're going to have to earn your PhD to make those criteria fit your environment. And I said, yeah, okay. His environment's different than ours. The principles are the same, but you got to make the applications differently, or you have to consider different things in making those applications. In our case, successful no-tilling for the most part, besides your weed control and the timeliness of it, it's all based around timeliness and meeting your moisture requirements. If everybody's seeding in the dry, no-tilling and conventional is going to be no different. But if we can reach moisture and we can get it in, then we can probably do better with no-tilling, and it'll certainly be better on the ground. No-tilling, I thought I reached the pinnacle when I got the erosion stopped, and then all of a sudden, that's not getting to our soil health. We're still degrading. And Dr. West down at Oregon State kind of pointed that out to me. I went to the Pendleton stations several times for their field days and one thing or another. His research down there on erosion and they were doing no-tilling and they were have long-term projects down there, plots. They started no-tilling in early 90s, I think, and they had about 10 years or 12 years of experience. Anyhow, it came out, they showed the graph. It says, no-tilling. It took the steep line out of the degrading of the soil, but it didn't get it above the neutral line. It stayed a little bit low. So when they replaced fallow with peas, then they were able to just kind of tweak that into the upper side. But I looked at that and I said, they had no residue. There was nothing in that plat. And I said, well, we got a lot more residue. So I was hoping maybe we were doing a little bit better than what they were doing down there.
And it's kind of a double-edged sword, all that residue, from what I understand.
It's just a problem.
I also hear that it's a byproduct of growing a whole bunch of wheat, which I feel like is not always a bad thing.
We have a lot of residue on in most of the places. We got places that don't have much. But a lot of our weed control is the fact that we just leave a hostile environment. We don't move any. We haven't moved anything since 1995 on our field. There's been no harrows, no anything except a drill, a sprayer, and a mower. That's the only thing we've had on there. So, you know, the molehills and all of that are a problem. I mean, can be a problem. But the seed hits that residue, it's got a jump in air gap. So it's a hostile environment. We don't have a lot of fall volunteer. Late, yes, you can finally see some of it coming up. But the early fall volunteers you see on a lot of the fields out here, we just don't have. So we consider that residue as helps us in our weed control. Also leaves all of that seed in that up there where there's a lot of granivores type critters out there that eat everything. And we try not to disturb them. Most of our weeds that we find now are in our wheel tracks. For 10 years, we've seen that we, you know, gosh, there's nothing in this standing stubble. That wheel track has got quite a bit. You know, well, there'll be a little bit though. But so we spray out our wheel track, we make a new wheel track, so then we have to go spray the weeds out of that. I've thought for a long time, if we could just get rid of those wheel tracks, we could cut a lot of our chemistry out. And we haven't been able to do that. There's a new technology just sitting on the edge waiting for us, and that's drones. And I learned about them last year. I was hoping to have one by now, but the licensing is an issue. We were at a meeting yesterday where I think I'm going to have a fellow who can help us on that. I think we will bring a drone operation up here this year and maybe do some acreage with it. He's willing to come up. We can't go out there every 2 weeks or 3 weeks, whatever it might be, with a ground rig. We just can't do that. But a drone we can do.
So, ooh, that's exciting.
It is exciting. I'm really excited.
All right. I might let you off the hook on the third one because you've got the upcoming awesome, crazy thing that you're going to do.
We're going to spend some money on that one. And that's probably going to be my next big jump.
Yeah. No, I mean, but I have heard, you know, throughout these, the privilege of doing these interviews, people have shared that various methods of more precision application of weed management strategies is really effective at cutting costs. And so whether that's spot spray technology like the Weed It or others, or mapping, are you thinking like mapping your weeds and then going out there and spot spraying with the drone?
Yes, one of the drone operator I was talking to, he's developing his own custom operation. His comment now, he says, well, he says he can map the weeds in the field now. We're thinking about the T40s and the T50s that's coming out here this summer. And he said, well, I might even be going back to a T20 because he says it's going to be easier. And he says, I have the capability of mapping weeds in the field. And then the little T20 can go out and just hit those. And I said, well, that's kind of intriguing. He's mostly in an orchard and that type of thing now. But he's broadening. He's on a learning curve too. You know, new technology, if you just wait a little bit longer, it'll get a lot better. Mm-hmm. But you can always save your money and not ever get to that new technology.
Yeah.
So you gotta leap someplace.
Find that sweet spot. I heard from, so Amy McKay was on the podcast, and she's one that actually also talked about using the, spray drones. And, you know, she said with the money they saved, her husband was going to take her to Belize.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Or maybe buy a weed. I don't know.
We'll see where that goes. I'll have to follow up with her.
But no, I do imagine, you know, in the name of crazy things, I like the jump forward. I heard when you were saying you were going into minimum till and putting farm equipment together or tillage equipment together to make a more single pass type of tillage operation.
Reducing our pass. I hear people say, you know, so we get together and they have all of this discussion and ideas and they just with their neighbor. I never talked with anybody. Nobody ever talked to me about it. It was just like we seem to be kind of on our own little planets and do our thing. I'm sure they're watching.
Oh, I bet they were curious.
I hear third and fourth parties around that said, well, I didn't know he was watching that. As I mentioned earlier, I don't hide anything. It's all out there, and some of them doesn't look very pretty.
That'll happen. I mean, you know, life's messy. Trying stuff's messy. Yeah, learning stuff, yeah. That can be messy. Yeah. I did talk to one of your neighbors here recently, and he gave a shout out to you. He sounds like he's learned a lot from watching you, too.
Well, I'm glad. I didn't know he did that.
Well, awesome. You'll just have to go listen to Doug's interview as well to hear that shout out. I wanted to give you a chance to share the name of your blog, because I know I've looked at it. I've enjoyed it over the years.
It's just named. If you Google Farming the Palouse, it's pretty well up on the screen at that point. It may not be the first one because there's a lot of pictures and that that's related to farming on the Palouse or in the Palouse or whatever. But Farming the Palouse is the name of it. I'm surprised how many pictures show up on the internet. It's off of my blog.
Yeah.
There's lots of them relating to the no-till and that. I was really shocked to find them. Nobody asked permission. I didn't care. But I was very surprised to see, oh, gosh, that come off my blog. So somebody was looking at it someplace.
You must be a good photographer on top of it all, huh?
Not really.
No, that's awesome. All right, let's do a quick lightning round. What's the most fun thing about trying new stuff on your farm?
Different. It's just, it breaks up the monotony. You know, farming is boring. To me, farming is boring. You got to do something to liven it up. I look at a lot of the operation around here. I said, my gosh, that operation has been doing that same thing as long as I've been alive. I couldn't stand that. I'd find a different. I was trained as an engineer, but I came to farm with my dad. A few wraps around the field, that's about enough for me. So all of this innovation, some way, it was just a break of the normal to do something different. The off-farm stuff I did. I was on the hospital board for 20-some years. I was in the conservation movement for 23, 24 years. That was mostly a break. For me, a lot of that was a break to get off the farm to something different, get different people. It was to break up the monotony. I just could never do a lot of them together. I only did one at a time because I was the main labor source. They couldn't let the operation go that long. You know, my engineering background as agriculture engineer. I was trained as a jack of all trades and a master of nothing. You had to go into the higher master's programs and that to really learn something. But it did give me the interest to and ability to make changes, and even though they were slow. But also piqued my interest to keep something. I would do something different. Just do it different. And don't die off of it, you know, so to speak. Operation go belly up or whatever. Learn how to back out of it. Learn how to take your time. But diversity of operation.
That diversity, coming back to that again, huh?
I could not see you just going around and around that field. It just don't work. A lot of people didn't do it, but I'm not one of good.
I see you're a very curious person. What is the most annoying thing about trying new stuff on the farm?
You know, you always have challenges, you know, trying to find parts, trying to get stuff in here. I've always been, the few pieces of equipment I have bought, they're never off the shelf locally. I brought in in 1980, I bought a crust buster drill with a brand new leading edge technology on the disc. It came in from Kansas through Rosalia, and I had that for years. So I bought built a cross saw drill, and that's New Zealand. So trying the most annoying thing or the problem area is always you have to inventory parts for your replacements or replaceable everything it wears. You can't rely, and any more or less, so you can't rely on going in and getting something off the shelf. That's annoying to have to wait. We waited over a year to get parts. And I waited long enough waited almost a year. I ordered up another group of parts from another location. It was only 6 hours from us, but they all came together at the same day. It was in Canada. It was hung up on a border. So by the time we got it through the border, the stuff that came up from New Zealand all came together the same day. So, but we weren't going to turn any of it back.
Yep, now you've got backup.
We will use it. It just take a little bit more time. But, it's money out there that originally wouldn't have had to spend immediately. But that would be the annoying. But I did that knowing the parts were not going to be off the shelf, so you prepare for it. So I can't really say it really annoyed me. Sometimes it gets a little concerning. You have to jerry rig around it, but you try to avoid that.
Yeah, well, it's part of farming too, isn't
it?
That's that ag engineering degree. I feel like you've had a lot of chances to ask scientists questions, but for the record, if you could ask a scientist a question, what would it be? Their most pressing at the moment.
I don't have one.
It's because you go to all the field days and you ask them there.
Well, I do. I do go to the field days. I ask them, but mostly I'm just seeing where they are against what we're doing. And there's nothing that they are doing or not doing that I'm not going, it's going to affect how I, if they really have an innovation that comes up, I perk my ears up. But, I'm not an innovator. I would call myself a early adopter. I'm not sure I've ever had an innovative thought in my head, but I see this stuff out there, and I think I do have a knack to say that has a potential. I'm going to try it, or no, that I'm not going to deal with that. But, we're not that big an operation to start with, just to be throwing a lot of stuff out there. WeedX is a great technology, that whole concept. I've looked at it a lot, and I like what it's trying to do. It's never been something I really wanted to deal with because it's horribly costly. It doesn't quite add up to its billing yet. It's doing better all the time. But it's not one of those things that, I got to have that thing. Mm-hmm. That's not a piece of technology that I got to have.
Well, it sounds like you're going a different direction, though, to get at a similar management goal.
Exactly. And I think the drones are going to help me when we get to that. It's going to help. We have done, our heavy residue helps us on the weed issues. The try to cut down the tracking is going to be a big thing for us. One of the most frustrating things, I think, we can cut our weed population down a lot, but we can't cut our spray operation out. I got maybe 100 weeds. I've cut it down from 1,000 weeds, but I still got to go after those 100 weeds. And right now, there's no way. That's what intrigues you with the WeedX and those type of technologies, particularly if you can get it out in the crop, which I guess they're starting to now even able to do a little bit. But you can cut that down If you got a lot of the situation, you could probably make the Weed-X work, but we're not big enough for that yet.
Okay, and last but not least, is there anyone who you would like to nominate to be on the On Farm Trials podcast?
I think that you've already got everybody that I would list.
Tracy, it's been such a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for taking your time, having me out to your place, and sharing your experience. It's been
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I enjoyed the time.
Likewise.
Yeah.
As always, a big thank you to our guests today for sharing their wealth of knowledge and experience with us. This podcast is produced by the PNW Farmers Network team with music credit to Carlos Flores. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers alone and do not represent that of the PNW Farmers Network or any associated agencies. Please remember that experimental results will vary, and listeners are encouraged to try things at home. If you like what you heard, please support this work by sharing, rating, and reviewing. And do consider joining us as a guest or nominating a friend who is trying things on their farm. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, happy trials.